Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning. Welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters. I am your host, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative. And today I have with me our regular contributors, Pastor David Whitney, Senior Instructor at the Institute on the Constitution in Pasadena, Maryland, and Mr. Phil Duffy, Instructor of the Constitution at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. We've got another unique show lined up this morning. Who else in American radio is taking on these controversial issues? Well, okay, I know some are, but not enough of them. We're going to talk today about presidential executive orders. Last week, on Labor Day, no less, while the rest of us were enjoying a day off, the president was hard at work signing an executive order which grants paid sick leave for all federal contractor personnel to take effect on 1 January of 2017. Was this a proper use of executive power? On April 1st of this year, and I don't think it was intended as an April Fool's joke, President Obama signed Executive Order 13694. Not only does this executive order declare a state of national emergency regarding cyber threats, it provides the government the power to confiscate all property and interests in property that are in the United States belonging to any person determined by the Secretary of the Treasury in consultation with the Attorney General and the Secretary of the State to be responsible for or complicit in or yada yada cyber-enabled activities originating from or directed by persons located in whole or in substantial part outside the United States. So is this another proper use or improper use of executive orders? President Obama has been criticized previously for some of his executive orders, but to date he has not suffered the fate of 32nd President FDR or 33rd President Harry Truman or 42nd President Bill Clinton, who all had executive orders overturned by the Supreme Court. But then there's still 16 more months left in this president's term. Our intrepid commentators hope to address these questions and others this morning, and I've designated, as always, the last 15 minutes of the show for your call-in questions and comments. Whether you're hearing this over a radio or over the Internet, starting at 7:40 this morning, you'll be able to call in with your questions or leave us a comment. The call-in number is 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-8255. If the primary number is busy, we've got alternate numbers of 610-539-1783 and 1784. The first caller of the morning will receive in the mail a nifty pocket constitution previously owned by Nancy Pelosi, so you know it's in never-read condition. If the lines are tied up, you can email us your question by sending it to info@1180wfyl.com. So let's get started. I'm going to start by asking Phil Duffy to provide us with an overview of where legitimate presidential power comes from, that is, constitutionally, and some of the proper and improper uses of executive orders on the part of previous presidents, such as I mentioned, Harry Truman and Bill Clinton. So, Phil, take it away.
Okay, Gary, there's no mystery about the source of authority for executive orders in the Constitution. It's in Article 2, which describes, among other things, the powers vested in the president. And according to the Constitution, the president may exercise remarkably few powers. The first mentioned power is very general, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, I find that one very interesting because every other public official is merely required to support the Constitution. So the president has a particularly high a barrier to overcome. So Section 2 of the article lists specific powers granted to the president in order for the president to perform his or her duties. They are specifically to be commander-in-chief of the armed forces when they are called to active duty. And the president doesn't have the power to call the armed forces to active duty. That's the responsibility of Congress, according to Article 1, Section 8. Second is to require in writing the opinion of the principal officer in each of the executive departments, the cabinet, upon any subject related to their duties, to grant reprieves and pardons, to make treaties provided two-thirds of the senators present concur, to appoint judges and other federal officials with the advice and consent of the Senate, but subject to such restrictions as may be imposed by Congress, and to temporarily fill vacancies while the Senate is in recess. And Section 3 of Article 2 adds the following powers. Give a State of the Union address on extraordinary occasions, and remember that language, extraordinary occasions. Convene both houses of Congress or either of them and adjourn them if there is disagreement between the two houses concerning adjournment. Notice nothing about national emergency there. Receive ambassadors and other public ministers and commission all officers. That's it. Now, that's most of the president's powers as described in Article 2. But there could be an implied power in other areas such as the census. So the president has the power to execute all laws under the Constitution. In other words, the president is the top enforcement officer for federal law. So what is an executive order? It is simply a direction from the president to execute any of these powers. It need not even be written, although for such weighty matters it would be imprudent, I think, to rely on a spoken word except for extraordinary circumstances. So what is the practical difference between an executive order and a regulation? Only that one is issued directly from the office of the president and the other from the executive department over which the president has control. So the legal force behind both is the same. Both regulations and executive orders that are outside of the Constitution should be found by the courts to be null and void. And, of course, there are many examples of that. An incoming president is no more bound by the executive orders issued by his predecessor than a new Congress is bound by the legislation of a prior Congress. For practical political reasons, of course, both tend to stay in the books unless they are specifically retracted or modified. And I think historically it's interesting that more than 7,300 presidential proclamations have been issued since 1789, and there are various estimates of that, by the way, so it's difficult to fix on a single number. So according to one estimate, that could even double the number of proclamations. Now, Wilson and FDR led the pack with 1,791 and 3,728, respectively. And that's interesting because Wilson had two terms in office and FDR had 3 1/4. So who wins the Bronze Prize? Surprisingly, one-term Calvin Coolidge with 1,253 in a single term. That certainly deserves some investigation.
Well, Phil, can you give me an example of a little more recent president who's issued a controversial order?
Harry Truman is often cited as the president who overused the executive order. According to the National Archives, he issued 896 of them. But it's not the quantity of the executive orders that matters, but their constitutionality. So one of the most notorious during his term of office is Executive Order 10340, which directed the Secretary of Commerce to take possession and operate the plants and facilities of certain steel companies on April 8, 1952. And Truman's view of the legitimacy of this action is revealing. He stated, whereas on December 16, 1950, I proclaimed the existence of a national emergency, which requires that the military, naval, air, and civilian defenses of this country be strengthened as speedily as possible, to the end that we may be able to repel any and all threats against our national security and to fulfill our responsibilities in the efforts being made throughout the United States, throughout the United Nations, and otherwise bring about lasting peace. And he goes on and on and on with this rationalization. Now, we should remember that he was talking about the non-declared Korean War, which he called a police action. The U.S. Supreme Court ultimately found Truman's actions to be unconstitutional, but I suspect that historians have not placed enough emphasis on Truman's terrifying words, "I proclaim the existence of a national emergency." So hold that thought, and I'll come back to that danger later on in my comments. I think the second that's very interesting because it's fairly recent, William Jefferson Clinton issued 364 executive orders, which is not considered excessive. But his most significant departure from Presidents Reagan and Bush before him was his use, and some would say abuse, of his powers under the Antiquities Act of 1906 to designate millions of acres of federal land as protected national monuments. And the most controversial was the Proclamation 6920, which established the 1.7 million acre Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in Utah. But other designations are considered equally outrageous. It's interesting that when you think of this, a president can just take millions of acres away from the private sector or the states.
Well, yes, but so we're talking about national emergencies here. Shouldn't there be some provision in the Constitution for how to handle national emergencies when they do occur?
Well, in my opinion, there's insufficient attention given to the State of the Union when the current Constitution was framed in 1787. This was a period of economic as well as political chaos, a true emergency period. It's significant that the framers of the Constitution refused to allow the executive to proclaim an emergency period during which the Constitution and civil liberties could be suspended, because they understood that would be a temptation to establish a dictatorship. So let's contrast that with a great period of socialism in Germany that began with the conclusion of World War I, and ended with World War II and the fall of the National Socialists under Hitler. Article 48 was a provision in the Constitution of the Weimar Republic, established after the defeat of Germany in World War I, and the article allowed the Chancellor to rule by decree without the consent of the Reichstag, the parliament, the legislative body, if you will, although the president still held veto power. Legislation passed under this article of the Constitution was referred to as the Note for Ordnung, Emergency Decree, Article 48 was used by Adolf Hitler in 1933 to establish a dictatorship, which ended the Weimar Republic and ushered in the Third Reich. Now, it's interesting that only took Hitler a mere 12 months to suspend all civil liberties after he was given dictatorial powers. In the interim period, Paul Hindenburg had passed away, and Hitler simply said, "I assumed the office of the president." So now let's rethink Harry Truman's rationalization for seizing the steel mills. The danger lies in his words, "I proclaim the existence of a national emergency." If the Weimar Constitution is any guide to the future, granting the president the power to proclaim an emergency could lead rapidly to the suspension of all civil liberties in the United States and the establishment of a dictatorship.
Well, that's a scary thought, but as we're going to find out, the Congress took care of that unilateral declaration with the National Emergencies Act in 1976. We'll come back to that thought after the break. So that's a good summary. If we were to summarize it, I think we'd agree that the legitimate presidential power of executive order extends only to those enumerated powers and responsibilities that we find in Article 2. Would you agree with that?
That is correct.
Okay, so let's take a look now at how the Obama administration has performed in terms of executive orders. The president has signed 218 of them over a wide range of topics. Have they all been legal? Anything we should be concerned about there, David?
Oh, yes, a whole lot of things that we should be concerned about. Obama's famous for saying, "I have a telephone, I have a pen," indicating that he, as he said, when Congress was not responsive to what he claims are the needs of the nation, he was going to do an end run around the legislative branch and basically act as a legislator using his pen and his telephone to accomplish what he thinks is necessary for the nation. Now, we in our Constitution never gave the president any powers to create legislation, no, indeed only to enforce existing legislation. And as Phil has excellently pointed out, the real purpose of an executive order is to give instructions to the executive branch, that is, those who are under his direct supervision. Yes, he could give directions to the executive branch. Let's say, the post offices, someone important dies, and he could direct the executive branches to lower the flags to half-mast at all the post offices across the country, things of that nature. Well, instead, in the 218, the list that is extensive here, I'm just glancing at it right now, I see things such as the environment. We live just a couple blocks away from the Chesapeake Bay, but he claims the Chesapeake Bay protection and restoration efforts are under his direction. And so he issued Executive Order 13508 regarding the Chesapeake Bay. Well, this has nothing to do with any power that has been directly given to him in terms of actually supposedly cleaning up the bay. That's not his his purview. And this list goes on and on of the federal sustainability in the next decade. You find page after page of what the president has done is basically act as a legislator and a single legislator, because obviously he's not not voted on by each individual congressional district and so on, but acting as if he is both the Senate and the House in making many of these decisions. We might argue that there are some in this list that do fall under his purview as the head of the executive branch when he gives an executive order that technically tells part of the executive branch what they are to do, or things to do with the military. For instance, there was an alteration in the courts martial, the U.S. Manual for Courts Martial, amendments to that. So, yes, being being his purview of the military, okay, that would be legitimate. But most of these executive orders, as you read through this list of 218, have to do with areas that are not part of the executive branch's power to enforce the law. Here I'm just looking at his health care, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, efforts to combat antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Wait a minute. Who has given him power, or who has given him the authority to do actions regarding that? Or prescription drug shortages. So he issued Executive Order 13588 that when there are prescription drug shortages, this is what is to happen. We find that this president has an attitude towards our Constitution that is far worse than George Bush. We know George Bush said, I can't use the expletive of what he said about the Constitution, but basically he said it's a worthless piece of paper, and I think he was a violator of the Constitution in many respects. But this man has gone far beyond that, because his vision for our country, as he said just before he took office, that he intended to fundamentally transform America. Well, you have to ask, transform America into what? We are a constitutional republic, and it's quite clear he's been working every day in his administration to fundamentally transform us into his vision, which is a socialist vision of what he believes America should be, rather than what our founders said, a limited federal government. I think what we need to remember is the federal government only has legitimate power over areas that we the people have delegated to it through our Constitution. It's the doctrine of delegated, enumerated, limited powers, and those powers are most clearly laid out in Article 1, Section 8, 17 items. It's not the only place in the Constitution that lays out powers, but they're a very small and limited list. And if we were just look at the areas that Obama claims that he has control over labor. So he's gotten involved in labor disputes, a Long Island Railroad Company, Executive Order 13654. In New Jersey Transit, there was a labor dispute there, Executive Order 13700. So he believes that labor is under his purview. Medicine is under his purview. The areas of railroad and their regulation and cooperation, science and technology, the stem cell research in the area of medicine, strategic computing initiative. The list goes on and on of things that he believes he has power to force the American people to pay for it, because each of these executive orders, you need to remember, involves a significant amount of money that is going to be spent, and regulatory powers that have to be watch to see who is doing what, if they're doing what the executive order actually says. Here's one on women and girls, violence against global or against global prevention of violence against women and girls. Like, where in the Constitution does it say that he has become the policeman of the world, that we have granted him power to be policeman of the world so he can direct the resources of our federal government to do something about violence against women and girls worldwide? This man really has a vision that he is king of the world, and that the fact that he is in the office as president means that he could do whatever he deems is best for the world, as he said famously that he saw himself as a citizen of the world, and wants to take us into the new world. He hasn't used this phrase, but we can see what he's doing, taking us into the new world order, that is, America disappears as a separate nation and becomes part of this community of nations that is governed by, well, the UN or some other agency that's developed that basically eliminates our God-given rights. So the question is, what is it that the people of this country should do in response to all these unconstitutional executive orders of the president? Well, I think the pattern is clearly set in our Constitution, that the House of Representatives draws up articles of impeachment. That's correct, articles of impeachment. I mean, some might say, well, that's a little extreme. No, it's not extreme. It's what the duty of the congressmen are, that they examine the actions of the executive branch as well as the actions of the judicial branch, and we've talked about them before, that impeachment is very appropriate for many of our black robe tyrants. But this tyrant in the White House, the list of things that are impeachable offenses is very, very long. In fact, if you want to, there's a lawyer that's drawn up a list of these. If you just Google the statement impeachable offenses Obama, you'll find multiple pages of a list of those offenses. And these executive orders are part of that list. Whenever the president acts outside of his powers, it's very difficult for you and I to have any influence. You might send an email or a letter or make a phone call to the White House. Very unlikely that they're going to listen to any of us. But what needs to happen is, if congressmen in the House were to be drawing up articles of impeachment for every action of Obama that violates the Constitution, and they don't have to look very long and hard to find that list, then at least the executive branch is put on notice that they are acting outside of the law. And if there's enough in the House of Representatives to actually pass those articles of impeachment, then the Senate is forced to hold a trial and try each one of those to see if the president is guilty, as the articles of impeachment charge him with. However, we don't have, it seems, any in the House of Representatives with a backbone to actually accomplish that task, which means our representatives either do not understand their job or they are unwilling to do the job that we, the people, have given to them to be a guard against tyrannical power that would emerge from the executive branch.
That's a good rundown, David, and thank you for that. When we come back from our break, we'll look at whether there are any other remedies besides the remedy of impeachment that we, the people, have to deal with a president who's exceeding his enumerated powers. So we'll be right back after these commercial messages. Don't go away, and get your questions and comments ready to call in.
Yeah. Working for your liberty right here in Philadelphia. Broadcasting freedom shining light throughout the tri-state area. Streaming freedom shining light from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station. WFYN.
News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. Donald Trump, at an event in New Hampshire, did not correct a man who claimed that President Obama is Muslim and not an American. Trump, in a statement this morning, saying, quote, "The bigger issue is that Obama is waging a war against Christians in this country."
Hillary Clinton wrote that, quote, "Donald Trump not denouncing false statements about POTUS and hateful rhetoric about Muslims is disturbing and just plain wrong. Cut it out."
Fox's Peter Ducey in Washington. Croatia closing all of its border crossings with Serbia, except for one with thousands of migrants coming in.
They're waiting here for buses that will take them to some of the reception centers that are being built further to the north and to various other towns around Croatia that are being prepared. And prepared is the key word here, I think it's fair to say, because the country simply wasn't prepared.
Sky News correspondent Stuart Varney in Tovarnik, Croatia. Fox News, we report. You decide.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
We the People t-shirts, where freedom is always in style. Famous quotes from patriots throughout U.S. history printed on the back of our t-shirts. We do over 25 quotes in a variety of colors. High-quality t-shirts with a meaningful message that make people think. Encourage others by reminding them about patriots of conviction who have gone before us. Order directly from wethepeopletshirts.us. For more information, call 757-645-8878.
A nation of well-informed men who have been taught to know and prize the rights which God has given them cannot be enslaved. It is in the region of ignorance that tyranny begins. A quote from Benjamin Franklin.
Welcome back to We the People, the Constitution Matters. We are talking about presidential executive orders today, and we heard from Phil Duffy how the legitimate use of presidential executive order extends only to the enumerated powers of the president as outlined in Article 2 primarily, but a few other places in the Constitution. And then we learned from David Whitney how this current president has abused this power, and other presidents have as well. And some of those presidents have found out that the Supreme Court takes a different view at, on occasion to their executive orders. So let's look at another area in our remaining time, an area that should concern every American, and that is emergency executive orders, or those dealing with a state of emergency should one be declared. Now, Phil Duffy told us that part of the concern over Harry Truman's executive order was his statement that he had declared a state of emergency, and that gave him the power to take over the steel mills. Well, the Congress finally settled the question of who gets to declare states of emergency by, in 1976, passing the National Emergency
National Emergencies Act, and it does give the president or the Congress the ability to declare a national emergency, but such a state of emergency can only exist for 1 year, and then it must be renewed by the person who declared it or the agency that declared it. And after 6 months of a state of emergency, the Congress has the authority to review the circumstances of under which it was declared, and then say that no longer are under a state of emergency. They can reverse that declaration, but that 6 months could result in a lot of changes to the way we conduct our affairs. When you look back at 1961, 1962, you'll find out that we took a very different stance to emergency preparedness back then. And those of us my age will recall that we were leading up to the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was in the fall of 1962 that missiles were photographed in Cuba, strategic missiles, nuclear-tipped missiles that Russia was preparing to deploy there. And in October, we had the 13 days of both countries staring each other down over the confiscation of goods and embargoing of shipping going to Cuba. And finally, Khrushchev blinked and backed down. But leading up to that, we can see that our government knew that something was up, that there were certainly increased tensions between the two countries. Either country could wipe the other one off the face of the map with its nuclear arsenal, and so there had to be some preparations. In 1961, President Kennedy's executive orders were a mix of very innocuous routine actions, such as establishing the President's Commission on the Status of Women, which was Executive Order 10980, and then Executive Order 10975 investigated a dispute between my old employer, Pan Am World Airways, and certain of its employees. But as 1962 dawned, we see a change. And on January 12th, Kennedy signed Executive Order 10985, which was relating to safeguarding official information in the interest of the defense of the United States. It certainly took a decided turn in tone. And the very next month, a month later, on February 16th, was a very busy day for Kennedy's pen. He very quietly signed 10 more executive orders dealing with national preparedness. Preparedness for what? Well, at that time, I think the astute observer of the news would know that tensions were mounting and that there was a likelihood of, or at least not the likelihood, but certainly the potential for nuclear war with the USSR. We were doing duck and cover drills in the schools, and on that day, the 16th of February, Kennedy signed executive orders assigning emergency preparedness functions to all of his various secretaries, one by one. So if a declaration of national emergency was going to happen, the government would control all communications media, all electrical power, gas, petroleum, fuels, and minerals in the country, all food resources and farms, all health, education, and welfare functions would be under federal government control, even those at the state level. Executive Order 11000 gave the Secretary of Labor the authority to mobilize citizens into work brigades under government supervision. The postmaster would have the authority to create a national registration of all persons. And under 11003, the administrator of the FAA would control all airports and all aircraft, including privately owned aircraft in the country. The Interstate Commerce Commissioner would control all railroads and inland waterways and public storage facilities. So this is a plenipotentiary power that we would be giving the President of the United States or the secretaries under his command to control just about every aspect of public life. Is that the kind of power we want our government to have? Well, to step back and just look at the situation. If there is a truly national calamity, do we not want the government to be able to take certain steps to keep things under control, to to manage the resources of the country appropriately. I think we probably do. If there had been a nuclear exchange, certainly there has to be some entity that steps in and makes sure that events are prioritized, that resources are prioritized, and takes control of the country, basically. So there are circumstances where I think we want our government to have this power, but it is indeed an awesome power, and in the wrong hands could certainly be used to our detriment. Could certainly be used to install a tyrannical government. Combine that with the fact that right now our nation is at its lowest ebb in terms of its trust of its government. Polls show that only about 13% of Americans trust the government to always do the right thing at the right time. So we've got this awesome power potentially in the hands of a government that very few people trust right now. And that's not a good situation. We need to do something to address that. But President Kennedy's orders are not the only ones that dealt with this situation. Gerald Ford Lyndon Johnson signed Executive Order 11310, allowing the Department of Justice to take over the control of correctional facilities. Gerald Ford signed an emergency preparedness order. Ronald Reagan signed one. So all of the presidents really are both guilty and complicit in setting up the potential for a tyrannical government to control everything in the country. Now, at least for 6 months, the Congress would be enjoined from doing anything. They would be powerless to prevent a continuance of this state of emergency. And even then, we wonder whether the Congress could act to really put things right if they use their powers under the National Emergencies Act. So this is an area of great concern. And I mentioned earlier in the first half that besides the awesome remedy of impeachment, there might be some other remedies. Of course, the Congress could enact legislation to counter any specific executive order. That is, they could, if the president says, I can do this, I can take private property of people that my attorney general declares to be basically enemies of the state, whether American citizens or not, well, then Congress can pass a law that says otherwise. Now, they'll have to get it signed by the president, and he probably wouldn't sign such a thing, but then they have the veto override feature. So if the Congress had the political will to set aright some executive order, they could do it. And likewise, the Congress has the power of the purse. They have to finance every activity of the government. And so if they object to some secretary doing something under an emergency order, an executive order, they could unfund that activity with their, once again, their legislative power once they have the veto-proof majority to do that. So there are some remedies short of impeaching the president, but it requires the will of the Congress. Now, what happens if the will of the Congress just isn't there? Well, that's where we have to turn to the will of the people. The will of the people is, in the end, the power behind the Constitution. David alluded to this earlier. All political power comes through the people to their government and needs to be kept in that regard. That is, the Tenth Amendment shows us that whatever power we have not given the federal government, we still retain, or perhaps the states retain it, and the states can use it under the doctrine of the lesser magistrate, and they can interpose themselves between the federal government and the people and protect the people through their use of power at the state level. So there are some remedies, but ultimately it evolves to the American people. What do we want to happen in this country? Are we comfortable with what our government is doing? And if we're not, then we need to be talking to our representatives, our senators, and making clear to them that we're uneasy with certain executive orders that the president has implemented, or we're downright concerned about it, not just uneasy, that we want the Congress to take a look at this, investigate it, and see if it is, in their view, a legitimate use of power. David, what would you add to that? If we have the Congress giving or having certain power to counter these executive orders, but ultimately, how do the people exert their power?
Well, the other element that needs to be interjected here is that any power that the executive branch claims that's not granted to the federal government in the Constitution, like cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay, let me just use that as an example in my own backyard here, there's nothing in our Constitution, other than misinterpretation of the Constitution, that would grant the federal government any power to do anything about the Chesapeake Bay. Well, if the state of Maryland were to say, federal government, sorry, but you are out of line in this case, and we're not going to allow you to enforce, at least within the boundaries of our state, obviously the state of Maryland cannot say anything about what the next-door neighbor states might or might not do, but certainly within their own state they could say, federal government, here's the constitutional line, do not cross this constitutional line, and if you do, here's the pushback that you'll receive in the state of Maryland from both the police and the sheriffs and so on, that you do not have power to do unconstitutional things within the boundaries of our state. What you do in another state, that's that state's business, but in our state, our bound and sworn duty is to uphold the Constitution, which involves in holding the line against the federal encroachment of state powers. In other words, that 10th Amendment issue is something that every state legislature, as well as every state executive branch and judicial branch, should be very, very careful to guard. It was Jefferson who warned us that don't allow any usurpation to take place by the federal government of those powers that have not been granted to the federal government, but have been reserved either to the states or to the people. So if we understand where that line is, it is the job of our state to protect us as citizens from federal encroachment across that line. And all of these executive orders about the emergency, Gary, that, you know, imagine that they can round you up for 6 months and put you in a work camp. Wow, doesn't that sound like a USSR? That all they have to do is, oh, there's a state of emergency. Let's see, there's a bird flu epidemic, and that's a state of emergency and a potential. We're going to round up all these people, put them in work camps for 6 months. And what? This is not America. This is a communist Russia or something of that sort. So we need our state governments to understand and defend that line against usurpation on the part of our federal government.
So you're kind of suggesting that each state should promulgate a general purpose nullification law that says,
yes,
we're drawing a line in the sand, and if there are any unconstitutional uses of federal power, we just declare right now that we are going to oppose them. We're going to not use any state resources to enforce them, etc. So not necessarily a nullification law based on a specific topic, but that each state should just pass a general purpose nullification law that says, here under the 10th Amendment's powers, we are declaring where we're going to start acting unilaterally. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, there may need to be additional ones as specific executive orders or other egregious actions are being taken or being prepared to be taken. I like the one that I wrote a blog, if people are interested in reading it, on the Obama believes he owns your pantry law. This is one of his executive orders. I think it's been 2 years ago now, where basically he said the contents of your pantry in your home become property of the federal government anytime an executive order declares that we're under a state of emergency. He can send his troops, his military troops, into your house and take all the food out of your house. And he can send his troops to every farmer and take all their farming equipment so that they have no ability to farm any longer, and take all of their feed and livestock. And, you know, basically, the food of America belongs to the president. All he has to do is say, there's a state of emergency. Well, if the states looked at that and said, in no instance will the militia of our state tolerate the federal government violating, well, I see it basically as a principle of the Third Amendment here as well as the Tenth Amendment, but housing and quartering troops, and actually that executive order in particular I'm referring to spoke of the fact that basically Obama was saying, I'm going to feed my troops, and I'm going to feed them taking money out of your, or food out of your pantry to feed my troops, which is exactly what the Third Amendment protects us against.
Well, Phil, did you watch any of the presidential debate Tuesday night?
I did my best to avoid them.
Well, one thing that struck me is that the commentator asked a lot of questions, of course, about what are you going to do about Iran? What are you going to do about this national issue or that, refugees, illegal immigration? But I didn't notice a whole lot of questions about what are you going to do about the overreach of the federal government, and how are you going to deal with the massive amount of power that the federal government has now compared with what was intended under the original Constitution. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed as we approach this election in 2016. The people need to be expressing our concern over what is the correct constitutional order and how do we get back to it in this country. And we ought to be insisting that commentators in presidential debates put forward questions that deal with constitutional issues. Now, occasionally something will come up on the Fourth Amendment. Rand Paul is generally pretty reliable in bringing in the Fourth Amendment into a debate. Mike Huckabee will occasionally mention the Constitution. Governor Walker occasionally will mention it. But the commentators are what my problem is. The commentators are not asking probing questions about how we get back to a true constitutional order in this country. What do you say, Phil?
Well, you know, I'd like to just make a note of how bad this has gotten, based upon something that you mentioned.
By the way, Phil, we do have one caller, so keep it short.
Okay. You mentioned the thing about the antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and this is a little bit like suspending the law of gravity. Think of this. Now we have a president who claims he has jurisdiction over bacteria. How ridiculous is this? This is a battle that has gone on since the beginning of life on Earth, a very complex subject. We elect to have our ethicists in medicine deal with this, and now we have a politician come in and suspend the laws of nature. So if we've gotten to that point and we can't rely upon our media to pick up on that, I think the media is a loss.
Right. Well, I agree there. Well, let's go to David in Hampton, Virginia. David, what kind of a question or comment do you have for us? All right, go ahead, David. What is your comment?
Yeah, Dave Dietrich in Hampton. How you doing, Gary? Great show again. Three things. First of all, I think it's important to differentiate between the notion of power and authority. There are clear authorities vested in the different branches of government in the Constitution, but I will say that the power that one branch of government has, in particular the executive branch, is almost absolute, because all of the instruments of the federal government of power, military and all of the other agencies that have military force projection capability, are all vested in the president, or he has direct control over those, and that's where the real danger lies, I think. Okay, now I have two questions. What do you think is the difference constitutionally between an executive order and a so-called Supreme Court ruling? Because we see both of them treated at, or called the law of the land when it comes to that. And then the third thing is, you were talking about remedies of the people. Well, I will contend in organic law, one part of which is the Declaration of Independence, there is a very clear fourth right identified. And I thank you for your commentary.
Well, that's a great question, David. I thank you for bringing it up, because the issue of a Supreme Court opinion being the law of the land is something we dealt with last week, but is still of prime importance. The Supreme Court opinion is rightfully called an opinion, And that's what they put at the top of their opinion, the word opinion. And it, yet they claim it to be the law of the land. I think it only becomes the law of the land when we, the people, give it that status. If we consider to continue to consider it an opinion only, then I think we'll be rightfully employing the Constitution the way it was intended. The same with an executive order that operates outside legitimate responsibilities and powers of the president as specified in Article 2, doesn't necessarily have to be given the status of law. It is only law when the president is properly using his authority, as you would prefer, rather than his power. And yet, we have this innate tendency in this country to just say whatever the government does is fine. As long as I pay my taxes and they stay out of my hair, I'll just let them do whatever they want. And that's why we are in the situation we are. David, would you have any other view of that?
Well, yes, but let me refer to his final point, which I appreciate his reference to our Declaration of Independence, that we basically says we have a God-given right at all times because government is only by consent of the governed. We, the people, have to consent to be governed by whatever form of government there exists. So we always have the unalterable, inalienable right to alter or to abolish the government when we deem that the government no longer fulfills its God-ordained duty, that is, its God-ordained duty is to protect and defend our God-given rights, not to redistribute wealth, not to, you know, do all these other things that the government currently does. So at that point, we the people could say, this government is no longer functional. And some have commented that many Americans may be reaching closer to that conclusion, particularly that both political parties, the two big-box parties, are being rejected by the voters in what we see in the polling. That only the outsiders, not even the best of the insiders who are in Washington, D.C., only the outsiders are being considered by both people who are considering voting Democratic or Republican. So we may be reaching a point where many Americans are realizing Washington, D.C. is terribly broken and needs to be pushed aside, and we restore the republic that was designed by our founders. One other comment, if I could just interject, the idea that the president has the military under his power is only true when there is a declaration of war by Congress. Without a declaration of war by Congress, there's not supposed to be a standing army in our country, according to our founders' design, a standing navy, yes, but not a standing army. And therefore, he has no power over the military unless there's a declaration of war, which there has not been since World War II.
Well, that's a good point, and we're almost out of time. Let me leave our listeners with these words of John Marshall, our most famous Chief Justice. The people made the Constitution, and the people can unmake it. It is the creature of their will and lives only by their will. So the American people need to rise up and take back their government. That's what it comes down to. Thanks for joining us on We the People, the Constitution Matters. We'll see you next week. Bring a friend.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
The liberty of the press consists in the right to publish with impunity truth, with good motives, for justifiable ends. To disallow, it is fatal. Alexander Hamilton, 1804. From Ronald Reagan, the nearest thing to eternal life we will ever see on this earth is a government program.